From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the play Avenue Q first opened on Broadway 10 years ago, part of its appeal was the shock value of cuddly puppets dropping the F-bomb. These weren't just puppets, of course. They looked an awful lot like the Muppets many of the audience had grown up with. And in fact, that's part of the idea of the play. What would happen if a puppet moved into another neighborhood where people weren't always so reassuring? What if they had bills to pay or went through a messy breakup? But of course, it's not the first time puppets have dealt with adult themes. In fact, most puppets in history have been vulgar and violent and petty. Avenue Q has just opened in Salt Lake City, so we're talking about the play, but also the role and the craft of bringing an inanimate object to life. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. It's been 10 years now since the play Avenue Q opened on Broadway. For those not familiar, it's a musical that features puppets, characters who are animals and monsters and look and sound an awful lot like Muppets. But there's a big difference. The puppets in Avenue Q have grown up. They've left the comfort of a place like Sesame Street for a neighborhood they can afford. They have to make rent. They have a real sex drive. They curse. They can be jealous and petty. The play has been remarkably popular, and part of that has to do with the novelty of cuddly characters being naughty. But none of that is going to work if you don't get the puppets right. None of the jokes will work if you don't believe that creature is alive. The master puppeteer Jennifer Barnhart, who is in the original cast of Avenue Q on Broadway, has said that you have to bring an element of truth to a puppet. If you don't believe a figure I'm manipulating, she says, is looking at you, we can't proceed from there. The University of Utah's theater department has just opened Avenue Q at the Babcock Theater on campus, and it gives us a chance to talk about the play, but also about the craft and the history of puppetry. You can join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Bob Mondello is joining us for part of the hour today. He is, of course, arts critic for NPR, where he reviews film. He's also a lead theater critic for the alternative weekly Washington City paper, and joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. And Bob, welcome back.
Hey, Doug. It's great to be here.
David Schmidt is also with us. He directs the University of Utah's production of Avenue Q. He's head of the voice area in the university's Department of Theater. And David Schmidt, welcome to you.
Thank you.
I'm going to bring Jennifer Barnhart onto the program here in just a moment, but I want to start with Bob and David here first. So, Bob, I guess we need to kind of begin by putting the play in perspective. And I guess the thing to say is it's all about that contrast. You've got these soft and cuddly puppets that, you know, a lot of people are pretty familiar with, mm-hmm. though they're dealing with the not so cuddly realities of life.
Well, yeah, it's not that they're uncuddly. It is that, it's just that it is real life. It's all about things that you and I think about. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting to watch puppets doing that and to believe in them. And what I remember vividly about seeing the show in its original production on Broadway was that it really I was persuaded by the puppets and all apologies to the puppeteers. I forgot they were there after a while. I mean, they're standing there, they're in full view, but I kind of forgot about them and was watching Rod and his friends.
I want to come back to that point because I think that's an important part of it. David, it'll be interesting to hear if you think the novelty, if not the shock value, of Avenue Q is wearing off over time. But let's put it in the context of when it opened. Did it seem particularly shocking, not just because you had puppets cursing and having sex, but puppets that we kind of knew. You know, these were the figures for the most part that we at least thought of from Sesame Street. In some way, they were kind of built around the idea of a Muppet. So that seemed all the more shocking, I guess.
Very shocking. I also saw the original production and happened to take my sons, 12 and 15, with me on Broadway.
You're brave.
And when the sex scene happened, I was literally covering my eyes because I thought I should not be watching puppets do this.
Right.
It was shocking.
Well, there's a whole song about pornography, and that's kind of delicious. The idea of that is so crazy. But the internet is for porn. I mean, I still know how that melody goes. And it's been 10 years since I heard it.
Well, I want to play a clip from that, actually, Bob, and maybe you can set this up, because it really does, it kind of does illustrate the conceit for the show.
Well, I don't think it takes a whole lot of setting up, really. It's he is asked about the internet, and he tells them what it's for.
Yeah. David, who are the characters who are engaged in this particular song?
In this particular number?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Kate has just found out that she gets to teach her kindergarten class for a morning, and she is going to teach them something relevant and something new and interesting, and it is about the internet. And Trekkie gives his opinion of what that should be.
Here it is from the play, Avenue Q.
The internet is really, really great.
For porn.
I got a fast connection so I don't have to wait.
For porn.
What? There's always some new site.
For porn.
I browse all day and night.
For porn.
It's like I'm surfing at the speed of light.
For porn.
Trekkie.
The internet is for porn.
Trekkie.
The internet is for porn.
What are you doing?
Why, you think the net was born? Porn, porn, porn.
Trekkie.
Oh, hello, Kid Monster.
You are ruining my song.
Oh, me sorry. Me no mean to.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, please, being quiet for a minute so I can finish.
No, it's hilarious. I'm just thinking as I'm listening to that that Hollywood is finally catching up with that notion. There was just a Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie that came out that is essentially about this very – that it could have been designed from that song.
Well, I mean, we're talking about 2003. So how were people reacting? I mean, it was really popular, this show.
It was not just really popular. It won the Tony Award that year against a much bigger musical that has outlasted it on Broadway, actually, Wicked.
Wicked.
Which was a very big deal. And I remember they launched quite a campaign to make the little underdog musical, this little tiny thing, which was essentially a puppet show, into a contender for the top award. And Wicked, of course, as you know, is an enormous show. It's a huge, millions and millions of dollars more to put it on, enormous sets, all that kind of thing, and a very different kind of score. And it won anyway. It was very nice.
Yeah. Bob, you pointed out to us yesterday, both Wicked and Avenue Q are kind of trading off of this notion of childhood things being made adult, or at least, I guess, stripped of the romanticism of childhood.
Yeah, I hadn't really ever thought about that until when I was looking at this show and thinking about what it was bringing to the table back then. And it was interesting that both of those shows, and this probably says more about Broadway than it does about anything else, but both of those shows were dealing with things that we remember from childhood. I mean, The Wizard of Oz in one case and The Muppets in the other, and bringing to them a really adult context, a way of seeing the world today. And of course, you know, all of us who are baby boomers and who grew up with all of the things we did, and we were a very coddled generation, carried that with us, I think, to some extent. And so it's really intriguing to be made to look at the world through things that you thought were sweet and innocent, but that you can sort of see, oh, well, there's other aspects to that now.
Yeah. David, this is the idea of the play, right? I mean, despite all we've been told on Sesame Street, maybe we're not all that special because we have to fit into the realities of life.
Exactly. I remember raising my children, telling them how special they are, and then they get out in the real world, and they have all these lessons to learn. The interesting thing about this production is that they're students. They're actually the age of their characters playing these parts, learning these lessons in real life and on stage.
Well, you know what I thought was interesting is it deals with, yes, it deals with gay themes and deals with race and, as we heard, deals with pornography, but it also deals with certain economic realities that seem really relevant today, like they did, I guess, even more so maybe than in 2003. You know, young kids in college who have these degrees. They're not sure if they're going to work, if they're going to make any money at them.
Exactly. And that's exactly what these students are going through right now.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. We're making this sound very, very depressing almost.
Right.
And it absolutely is not. Keep reminding is how really wonderful and buoyant and exhilarating this show is. And the spirit of it is so affirmative and so embracing and kind of wonderful. And, I mean, you know, I was thinking about other kinds of shows that use puppets, War Horse, for instance, which used them to be they created life-size horses on stage with puppetry, and it was really impressive. But what everybody was talking about for that one was the beauty of the movement. It was a different kind of thing. And the same thing is true of The Lion King, which also uses a lot of puppets on stage. And again, what you're amazed by in that is the gorgeousness of it. It's all about Broadway spectacle in a way. This isn't about that. This is puppetry being used in a much more sort of elemental and simple way to draw in an audience that might resist things otherwise.
You know, what's interesting, I think, about the play also is that you've got some human characters we should mention. You've got three mm-hmm. human characters, 11 puppet characters, if I get that right. But the play doesn't really make all that much of a distinction between the humans and the puppets. It's almost like I don't get why is there a puppet and why is there a human?
There is no distinction between the two. The humans look at the puppets when they talk. They do not look at the puppeteers. They look at the puppets and they communicate and they hug the puppets and they talk to the puppets. Absolutely no distinction. And in the beginning, it's confusing. And then about 5 minutes in, you're right with them.
That's the idea, right? I mean,
yes.
You want – you've got – right, Bob? You've got to forget that is a puppeteer.
Well, totally. But I'm told that this happens anyway. Elizabeth Blair, one of my colleagues here at National Public Radio, once had to interview a Muppet. It was Elmo, I think.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful bit with her. And she was talking to me afterwards about doing it and about how very quickly she forgot about the guy who was manipulating Elmo and was just talking to him and was engaging with him and was laughing at things he said. Well, you know, she's sitting right there and she can see the guy who's behind the little, you know, desk. But it was all totally working for her, she said. she just embraced it. So apparently it works in real life.
So, David, what's the idea? The idea is that you've got to, as an audience member, you suspend reality. I mean, this is right. I mean,
we hope.
Yes, that's the idea.
And the note that I gave most in the directing process was, I'm watching you, not your puppet. And I needed to watch Kate, not Tia, who's holding Kate. And that's the lesson they had to learn, was to make those puppets come alive.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is, and I think this is a good time to bring Jennifer Barnhart into the conversation. It seems like it's crucial for the jokes to fall right, for the play to work. I've got to believe in that puppet. So they can be great actors. They can have a great voice. But they've also got to be able to manipulate the puppet. That's really critical, right?
Yes, and thank goodness we had Jen Barnhart come twice to work with us and teach us how to be puppeteers.
Let me introduce Jennifer Barnhart, master puppeteer. She was a cast member of Avenue Q throughout its 6-year Broadway run. Avenue Q closed on Broadway in 2009, but last night she joined the cast for an off-Broadway production at the New World Stages in New York City. She's been in Utah, as David mentioned, twice. She was here last month as an artist in residence at the University of Utah. She's joining us today from a studio in New York. And Jennifer Barnhart, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to ask you first, before I get to the craft of puppetry, what was the reaction, I'm thinking, in those early days from people who had a hunch about what this play was supposed to be about, but then when they, see puppets engaged in sex on the stage and using curse words and those kinds of things. I mean, what was this sort of visceral reaction from the audience?
Well, it was delightful performing for audiences in New York in those first couple of years because we were very much the show to see. It was sort of for the New Yorker. It was for the sophisticated theater goer. Because we hadn't blown up yet, no one outside of the city had really heard of us. But all of the New Yorkers said, oh, yeah, you got to see this show. You got to see this show. It's so funny and irreverent and wonderful. And hearing the waves of laughter and shocked laughter at some of the scenes that you mention is gratifying on the one hand. But on the other hand, the thing that I really took home with me from it were the comments from people after seeing the show who said, I expected to laugh at your show. I did not expect to be moved. And that would be when we felt like we'd really achieved something special with the show. And seeing audience members crying at the end of the first act when Little Kate Monster has a particularly poignant ballad about her broken heart. But, you know, being able to cause people to go on an emotional journey that was outside of what they were expecting. They thought they knew what they were getting, and then they were all pleasantly surprised to discover that it was something more.
Mm. Paul Bondello, you've talked about it as borrowing the magic from childhood. This idea of magic seems to come to play in a theme like this.
I mean, I think puppetry does that automatically. You know, when you were a little kid, when you were a little kid in the Dark Ages, there were Punch and Judy shows. Yeah. This is all about the kinds of things that we see as children, and it isn't just Sesame Street. It's also, puppet shows in all kinds of other things. When my father was growing up, he was enamored of Edgar Bergen
and Charlie McCarthy.
Well, you know, that was a ventriloquist who was famous on radio.
Radio.
I mean, figure that. It's like, you know, but the audience really, really ate up the whole notion of Charlie McCarthy and this puppet who was very smart. And I think, you know, that was what my dad grew up with. I grew up with a whole different set of puppet references. But yeah, you see them from when you're a little kid. And they are, in essence, very reassuring. And so, I mean, because you associate them with good times as a child, mm-hmm. with going to shows, with you know, it's a way of, I mean, for heaven's sakes, let's take this to a really dark place for a second. But it is when you're talking to a child molester to a child who you think might have been molested, they use a doll
right.
in order to talk about that. It is a way. These are reassuring creatures. And so it's a way to get to subjects sometimes that are not reassuring, and it's really interesting to see what it does to your perception of mm-hmm. them, to have it brought into your world in a way that is comfortable. And
yeah.
I think it's all about comfort.
Jennifer, what do you think about that? I mean, how do you think about the role that you're playing? You've been doing this for a long time now.
Well, it's not just in this show, but in terms of it being something from your childhood that you think of, there's a sort of a universal tendency that children all over the world have to personify objects and to make them move and to give them life and to give them little voices. So every single one of us has done that at one point or another. And at some point, you sort of put that aside. But then when a puppet comes into your experience, you do go back to a more open place, and it allows you to see things and connect to them in a different way. I have also been fortunate enough to work on a video series for refugee children in third world and war-torn countries by an organization called No Strings. It's a wonderful organization. Mm-hmm. And among the videos that we have done in the past, the organization did a video on landmine safety for refugee children in Afghanistan. And unlike a human documentary or a human performer, a puppet character can step onto a landmine and literally have its arm and leg blown off.
Yeah.
And you cannot do that, of course, with a child, and it would be horrifying. But with a puppet, it allows you to look at that. You can look at something that horrific in that way and also get it's a profoundly moving experience. You empathize. You're able to feel things. It gives you the room to feel things that you would not otherwise be able to confront. So the whole range of what puppets allow is pretty staggering, really.
A little bit late in the program, Jennifer, we're going to get to how you explain the gift. I mean, what it is that a good puppeteer is good at. Because I keep wondering, is it about dexterity? Is it about flexibility? But when you're on stage, you're supposed to be there, of course, but you're not really supposed to be there. There's one part of you that's supposed to be there. I mean, how do you explain your role as a performer in this particular play?
In Avenue Q specifically, it is challenging because I'm lucky enough to inhabit the world of being a puppeteer and an actor or a human performer, as I have now come to make the distinction. In this show, you end up doing both. It is a shared performance. The first time I was stepping into the show, I was trying to incorporate a sense of neutrality to my own facial features so that the focus would be forced to be on the puppet.
Huh.
But then I realized after hearing some feedback from the early preview audiences that that was in fact distracting for them to look at my face, not seeming as though it was emotionally engaged in what was happening with the character.
Right.
So I found I had to sort of bring my human chops into play as well and find a delicate balance between how much of my face is being emotive, how much focus should be on the puppet. It's a shared performance, not so much a split performance, but it is a shared performance. And many people who watch the show for the first 5 minutes, it's very much like watching, Rick Lyon said this, he's the original designer and builder of the puppets, and it's the original Nicky Trekkie. He said, and it was the best metaphor for it, watching the first 5 minutes of Avenue Q is very much like watching a foreign film with subtitles. For the first 5 minutes, you're very aware of your eyes going back down to the bottom of the screen, flicking your head up and down, almost like you're watching a tennis match.
Yeah.
But very shortly after that, it just becomes incorporated into the storytelling and you don't notice it at all. And when it's seamless, I think, is when it works best.
Is that hard, David, as a director, trying to get them to perform that physicality? I mean, you know, is that a challenge?
It was the biggest challenge of this particular production because it's students, theater students, musical theater students, learning to be puppeteers in a very short period of time. And with Jen's amazing help, they have done this. They really have.
Let me ask you this. Once the novelty or the shock wears off, and I want to get you all on this. David, you first. Once that shock wears off, is it hard to maintain the essence of this show?
No. When Kate gets her heart broken, the audience sighs. It's beautiful. It's just beautiful because before that, they're gasping and it's like watching a scary movie. I look at the audience during the show to see how they're reacting. And then when Kate has her heart broken, they're crying and, oh, you know, and sighing. It's wonderful.
So it's not just about the silly novelty of a cursing puppet. If it's only that, it wouldn't have the same kind of...
No, exactly. No, many, many, many touching moments for many of the characters, not just Kate.
Yeah. Bob, what do you think? Because it's interesting. I mean, Matt Stone and Trey Parker, you know, the creators of South Park, they produced the film Team America. This was just a year after Avenue Q in 2004. Mm-hmm. And it had some of the same kind of devices, you know, body and sometimes profane puppets. So what's the... You know, what's the novelty now of something like Avenue Q, you know, 10 years on?
The hassle with the question is that it's always been novel to a new audience. And it just goes back centuries, the use of puppets. I've seen puppets used in Shakespeare. I've seen puppets used in all kinds of different things. The novelty is always sort of magical. And I think, I hadn't really thought about it before. We were just talking about the idea of children playing with toys. But yes, we do give voice to things. And so it's a perfectly natural thing. And have you ever watched a four-year-old watching a puppet? Because it's really, I mean, the person manipulating the puppet disappears for the kid. You can tell. He believes in the reality of that thing. And what's wonderful about puppetry when it's done well on stage is that you fall into that pattern again and you believe. I confess to being a total sap, but I fall apart at this kind of thing. And I remember being moved by Avenue Q. Willing suspension of disbelief. I am the most willing suspender you can imagine.
That's Bob Mondello. He's arts critic for NPR. Joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Bob, good to hear your voice. Thanks very much.
It's always great to be with you guys.
David Schmidt directs the University of Utah's production of Avenue Q. It's opened on Friday. It runs through November 24th at the Babcock Theater. You can call 801-581-7100 for tickets, or we'll have that telephone number and all the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. David Schmidt, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Barnhart, master puppeteer and actor. She's going to stay with us when we get back from a break. We'll talk more about the craft of puppetry. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about puppets. It's been 10 years now since the musical Avenue Q shocked and surprised Broadway audiences by having soft, cuddly puppets dealing with and singing about decidedly grown-up stuff. The University of Utah's Department of Theater is staging Avenue Q at the Babcock Theater this month, so it's giving us a chance to talk about the show, but also about the craft and about the history of puppets. We have Jennifer Barnhart with us. She is a master puppeteer and an actor. She was a cast member of the original Avenue Q on Broadway. She's now performing in the musical Off-Broadway at New World Stages in New York City. She's joining us from a studio there. And we're also joined by Eileen Blumenthal, who's a professor of theater arts at Rutgers University. Her work focuses on the performing arts and on puppetry. She's a contributor to Puppetry International magazine, the author of the book Puppetry, A World History. She's also with us from that studio in New York City. And Eileen Blumenthal, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Well, I guess we should start with from the perspective of history with the question of what is a puppet? Because you say in your book, Eileen Blumenthal, that whenever someone endows an inanimate object with life and then casts it in a scenario, you've got a puppet. A puppet is born. So in that sense, a puppet can be all kinds of different things, but you, as long as you're sort of trying to imbue it with life and put it in a kind of scenario, that's a puppet?
I think that's a puppet. And by the way, that is as close to a definition of puppet as exists in that book, and it's as close to a definition of puppet as I can come up with.
Yeah.
The edges of what a puppet is are very, very fuzzy and porous.
You say humans have been doing puppet shows, or using puppets anyway, from deep, really deep in our earliest days as a species. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, it seems that as far back as we can go, we have evidence that people have taken the remarkable step of creating replicas of people or of people-like things and giving them jobs to do.
Right.
Those jobs can be ritual. They can be sympathetic magic. They can be fun. That seems to go way back, and it seems to be part of human history in just about every culture we can explore. And not just for children, for adults as well.
Yeah, well, that's an important thing that I want to get to, the idea that I think there's this sort of modern-day impression that puppets are supposed to be for kids, but that's just not been the case over time. But I wanted to ask you the role that puppets have played. Has it been that we've used puppets to kind of deal with the stuff that, you know, humans can't deal with, talk about the things that humans are not so good at, so we need a figure to do it?
That's one of the jobs that puppets have done. I mean, puppets have been used often as political subversives because they're it puts things at a little bit of a distance, and also it's sometimes hard to exactly tell who the guilty party is. But puppets have done just about everything that their human counterparts have done. It's just that puppets have greatly expanded abilities. As Jen was saying, for example, you can blow their arms and legs off.
Yeah.
But you also can give them all of the expressive possibilities of sculpture. And you can distill a movement, you can distill an emotion in a puppet gesture and then make it absolutely pure and stronger than anything a human could do. I don't think any human actor could be as vulnerable and scared as little Joey is in War Horse. And I have never seen sex as raunchy and ecstatic and totally over the top as the puppets in Avenue Q perform. And the fact that they only exist from the waist up doesn't seem to be any problem at all.
Right.
Because our imaginations fill in much better than human body parts could.
Jennifer Barnhart, I want to hear you on that question of distilling to a gesture, because you've talked to us about that before. The idea, what is the gift for a puppeteer? You know, what do the good ones have? Is it a physical thing like dexterity? Is it the ability to be fluid or something like, I mean, what is it?
It's usually the ability to make observations and be able to translate through the puppet and interpret through the puppet to get at the essence of that emotion or intention or gesture. When I'm working with a new puppeteer, for instance, in Avenue Q, last night I just joined the company and I'm partnering with a puppeteer I've not worked with before. Mm. And in the rehearsal hall before we went on stage, I said, okay, so show me in your body how you would do this scene, because I want to look at your hand gestures and I want to try to translate what it is you're doing into the puppet. Now, I can't replicate what you're doing exactly, but I can find the essence of it, and that I can replicate through the puppetry. So there's no extraneous gesture. There's nothing left over but what is essential to communicate an idea mm-hmm. or an emotion.
So when you're working with students, like you were at the University of Utah, what's the mistake they often make? What's the thing that they're doing wrong? If there is one common element that they don't quite get, at least at first.
Well, there are a couple of common elements that beginning puppeteers make when they're first trying their hand at a new instrument. I mean, because learning to puppeteer is a lot like learning a musical instrument. So when they're picking up the instrument and trying to make it do things, very often they're working so much harder than they have to. They'll be working their hands so difficult, you know, with such force and strength behind it. And you can see the effort in their faces and in their hands. And because there's so much tension there, it's binding the puppet. It's not letting the puppet move as freely and as openly as it can. So a lot of times over-muscling it and trying to do too much and trying to do too many gestures. You know, very often they'll do something where they'll want to nod in agreement and they'll do about 7 or 8 quick little nods,
yeah.
which really just makes the puppet look like it's having a seizure. But if you just do 2 simple nods, that's much cleaner and gets away with all the extra stuff that you just don't need.
Do you have to understand? I guess you have to understand human expression, really, to bring a puppet to life, because that's the thing that you're interpreting as a puppet. And we have to understand it as an audience.
Yes, absolutely.
So do you think you've been able to – do you pay more attention to gestures than the rest of us? You know what I mean? Do you pay more attention to the way humans express things, facial gestures, those movements that we might – you know, tapping of toes and, you know, being
a slight incline of the head.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I think I am more attuned to it. I mean, most actors are attuned to it anyway, but right. I do think that puppeteers – sort of go the extra distance and really hone in on what is the essence of the gesture and what is that gesture an essential expression of, whether it's an emotion or an idea or a behavior. So yes, I do find that I'm constantly studying people's body language on the subway and seeing what I can tell. I also often tell beginning puppeteers, because animation, film animation, whether it's drawing or computer animation, is a somewhat similar art. You're trying to evoke the image of life. So I will tell them sometimes to take their favorite Pixar film and turn the sound down and see if they can track what is happening emotionally in the character. Because I also really think that puppets work best when there are no words, when there is less language. Mm. I feel like the puppet can actually express more sometimes, paradoxically. But so I will use that as an exercise of saying, can you tell what is happening emotionally for the character purely through what you're seeing, not through what you're hearing, and trying to apply those principles to puppetry. So I think that's a very valuable tool.
Eileen Blumenthal.
An interesting side note to that.
Yeah.
This is Eileen. Is that there have been several instances in history when human actor theaters, or found actor theaters, as I like to call them, have actually patterned their gestures from puppet theaters. Mm. It's believed that Kabuki theater has taken a lot of its stylized gestures from the Japanese doll theater, the Bunraku theater. And in Indonesia, there's a kind of wayang that uses live actors that copies the puppet theater.
Yeah.
So it goes both ways.
I guess.
Well, the puppets have distilled it and then the humans copy it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I guess you can hide behind the puppet if things go wrong. Eileen Blumenthal, you write about the fact that there was one Czech puppeteer you write about who got himself out of hot water with the government by blaming his own puppet.
Mm-hmm. The puppets did it. Not my fault.
Yeah. Which that seems really telling, right? I mean, the idea that it's an extension of me. It's not really me. Blame the inanimate object that I brought to life.
And the other advantage of puppets for getting into trouble is that usually you can pack them up and get out of there really fast, much faster than a found actor theater could.
It's very true. But also dovetailing onto that, when I have a puppet character on, for instance, I will find if I'm improvising and just talking, for instance, when I was working with the students at the university, I brought the original Bad Idea Bear from the Broadway production. So I was able to, because as I was explaining to them, I said, look, we're trying to learn a foreign language here. And if you were taking a foreign language intensive, your teacher would only be speaking to you in French.
Right.
So I'm going to have a puppet on pretty much for all of rehearsal, and you'll be not talking to me, you'll be talking to this puppet. So, but periodically, the character of the Bad Idea Bear would take over, and she would say things that I wouldn't even know were about to come out. I mean, I as an actor would think, you know, maybe I, or as a human, I would think, I can't get away with saying that in front of these students. But my Bad Idea Bear would say it, it would come out of her mouth, and I would look at her as if she'd pulled a trick on me somehow. So puppets do have that incredible ability to take you outside of yourself in that way, and you can get away with a lot.
Jennifer Barnhart is with us, master puppeteer, actor, a cast member of the original Avenue Q cast on Broadway, now performing in the musical Off-Broadway at New World Stages in New York City. Eileen Blumenthal also with us, the author of the book Puppetry, A World History. The University of Utah Department of Theater has just opened their production of Avenue Q at the Babcock Theater. It's running through November 24th. Ticket information is available on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The play Avenue Q has just opened in Salt Lake City. It's being staged by the University of Utah's theater department at the Babcock Theater. It's giving us a chance to talk about the play, but also the role in the craft of bringing an inanimate object to life. We have with us Jennifer Barnhart, a master puppeteer and actor. She was a cast member in the original Avenue Q on Broadway. She's still performing in an off-Broadway production at New World Stages in New York City. She's joining us from New York. And Eileen Blumenthal is with us. She is a professor of theater arts at Rutgers University and author of the book Puppetry, A World History, also joining us from New York. I wanted to, Eileen Blumenthal, people I think raised on Sesame Street think of, or really any sort of child television from the like 70s and 50s and 60s, they think of puppets as kind of childlike and really tame. But this is kind of a fairly new idea, the idea that puppets were for kids, right?
The idea that puppets were only for kids is, in fact, a new idea. It started in the 19th century and pretty much only in the West. What happened was some other cultural phenomena happened, which tremendously affected theater. The main thing was, probably the main thing was Darwin. Who said...
Blame Darwin.
Blame Darwin.
Of course. Who pointed out that humans were products of their heredity and their environment. And suddenly, showing real environments and real situations became something that you really wanted to do in the theater, which meant... I mean, nobody cared what kind of furniture Lady Macbeth had, but it did matter what kind of furniture Miss Julie had. And suddenly, for the first time in history, theater started to replicate things that you would see in the real world. And I mean, that's really a bizarre thing to do. I mean, music doesn't restrict itself to sounds you hear in the real world. Sculpture doesn't restrict itself to materials and shapes in the real world. But theater started doing that. And although puppets are superb actors with abilities that I think surpass those of found actors in a lot of ways, realism is one area in which they really are not that good. They really can't compete with live actors. So suddenly puppets sort of had a they were sort of pushed out of the theater market. Mm. But fortunately, at around the same time, a little bit earlier, the whole notion of childhood had changed. And for the first time, people thought that children were not just half-baked adults, that they had special needs, and entertainment for children became its own phenomenon. So puppets kind of slid into that as an area where they could excel. And then they kind of got ghettoized into that area. In Europe, the ghettoization stopped almost immediately. There was all kinds of experimental theater, live actor theater, that realized that realism had painted theater into a corner and they were bashing their way out any way they could do it. Mm-hmm. And puppets did the same thing. But both of those happened less in America.
You write in your book that from the earliest times, puppets have been used to portray or, I guess, deal with sex. Sex has been a big theme in puppetry over the years.
Oh, yes. Puppets have been part of fertility rituals. Puppets have been part of sex education. It's a wonderful puppeteer who is South African, though he now lives in Australia, named Gary Friedman, who launched a big Puppets Against AIDS campaign in Africa. And he had puppets going around doing educational shows that really live human actors would not have been tolerated doing. And puppets have just been are great erotic figures. I mean, some of the most erotic theater I have ever seen was performed by puppets. Philippe Gentil, who is a wonderful French puppeteer, did a show in which he had both puppets and live actors in very erotic scenes. And toward the end of the show, you have nude actors and puppets, nude puppets. And the nude actors just look kind of, you know, not very well created. They're just not nearly as erotic as the puppets, who were designed with that in mind.
Wow. Puppetry over time has also been, as you point out in your book, really violent. And one reason you point out is something that Jen mentioned, you know, it can. You can blow up the arms off of a puppet and it can take a lot of abuse. But you say that hasn't been the only reason. It's usually irreverent, this kind of violence, but there's a lot of violence over time. What's going on with the violence in puppetry, do you think?
I don't know. I know that if you give puppets to two people who aren't puppeteers, one of two things happens. If you give two people a puppet each, either they start making love or they start beating each other up.
Right.
And I don't know what that's about, but they do it.
It's so true. I think part of it has to do with what is allowable and acceptable social behavior. And puppets give you license to do to break out of those boundaries, whether it's in acts of sex or violence. You know, it's a safe and acceptable way to vent some aggressions.
Yeah, yeah. Safe. That idea of safety keeps coming up. That puppets somehow they're a safe form. It's a safe space.
Well, because you can always put it down and walk away from it, and it stops being a living thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, it's easier to cast puppets than live actors in scenarios, for example, where they're going to be decapitated. You just have to keep casting an actor for every show if you...
Exactly.
Of course. You mentioned how in the days before Sesame Street, for example, puppets were blown up or bonked on the head, for example, if they chose the wrong brand of bread. I guess I had forgotten about that. Maybe I don't remember
that's kind of thing. In Jim Henson's work. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
You know, the thing that people, I think, often overlook about Sesame Street and also about Avenue Q is that I think one of the reasons Sesame Street was so successful and one of the reasons Avenue Q is so successful is that they're simply good theater. Sesame Street wasn't just, you know, good creative children's theater. I think Sesame Street and The Muppet Show were probably the best television of any sort in their heyday.
Yeah.
And Avenue Q, which I saw last night for the first time in 10 years, is just wonderful theater. It's, you know, it's well directed, it's well paced, it's got a wonderful plot. Having irreverent puppets will get you through about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But this is just good theater.
Here's an email from Stephanie, who writes, I've just finished reading the Brian Jones biography of Jim Henson. She writes, the evolution of puppetry during his lifetime was considerable. What do you think about the impact of Jim Henson? Eileen Blumenthal, I want to hear your perspective, but Jen, I want to hear yours too, because it seems Jim Henson, at least his work, was pretty influential in the way you do puppetry. But Eileen Blumenthal, put Jim Henson in context of that, you know, the broad story of puppetry.
I think Jim Henson helped to keep imagination alive, because I think most kids start out with wonderful imaginations, and then it gets squelched into what you're supposed to think as you think in straight lines. And I think he kept imagination alive for several generations now. And the other thing that a lot of people don't know about Jim Henson is that he himself did a lot of experimental puppetry, not only at the beginning of his career, but continuing alongside Sesame Street. And he also always supported other puppeteers doing work, really edgy work at the border of what's theatrically possible. And the Henson Foundation still does that. So it's a tremendous force for creative puppetry.
How do you talk
and creative
about,
theater?
Yeah. Jennifer Barnhart, how do you talk about Jim Henson, the influence he's had on your work?
Well, I mean, he's largely what drew me to this form in the first place. I had been a huge fan of The Muppet Show, particularly as a kid. Yeah. And I remembered how funny the puppets were and everything. And then when I saw the movie The Dark Crystal, mm-hmm. which was – and it was around the time that Star Wars had just sort of changed the face of science fiction fantasy filmmaking, and you could make a whole world do this. And Jim's response to that in some ways, I think, artistically, was The Dark Crystal, where he created a world entirely inhabited with puppets and sentient plants that moved and did things, and among other things. And it was such a beautiful story, and I remembered getting so swept up in it and thinking, wait a minute, the Muppets made me laugh, but puppets can do that kind of artistic myth and storytelling. I want to do that. So it really was my first inkling of wanting to do this. But what's interesting, too, about Jim is that I think he used puppetry as a means to explore what was then a burgeoning medium of television. Mm-hmm. And I think if he could have explored television as fully in another way, that he might have explored doing that. He just wanted to know how to work this medium. And he wanted to direct, and he had great, brilliant, creative ideas. And the one amalgamation that allowed him to do all of those things was puppetry. I still maintain that it's one of the few art forms, puppeteering for television specifically, it's one of the few art forms I'm aware of where you're simultaneously performing and directing, because you're looking at the picture that you and other puppets are composing. So I think that was what enlivened him as an artist, just wanting to find a mode of expression in what was then, again, a fledgling art form. And once he started exploring it, he really did, as Eileen says, start to nurture and foster it. In fact, when she mentioned Philippe Gentil, I was nodding and going, oh, yes, I have the Jim Henson Presents The World of Puppetry about Philippe Gentil. And he embraced the tradition and wanted to encourage other forms of puppetry to be better known in this country. Sadly, it never reached a mainstream following. But he, again, through the foundation, there continues to be a great influence thanks to him.
Jen, you've talked to us about how puppetry, as a performer, as an actor, puppetry really kind of brought you out of your shell.
Yes, very much so. As a performer, when I was a young actor, I loved doing period pieces. I loved being in big costume dramas because the costume told you how to move. Mm-hmm. It helped inform your physicality. But in terms of my own physicality, I was always the tallest girl. So that made me sort of hunch over a little bit, as tall girls are wont to do. I felt a little awkward in my own skin, and I didn't feel as though I moved terribly gracefully, and I didn't. And my movement classes for the actor in my freshman year at university it was so challenging and so difficult for me to break out of what I felt was the box of my own physicality. And there were times when it felt very frustrating and very overwhelming. But the moment I found puppetry, which was very shortly after that I started taking classes in college and exploring that, my ability to express other options, and I wish you could see my hands. I can't keep my hands still. I'm a puppeteer. I can't keep my hands still when I'm talking. But
I'll vouch for that.
But being able to explore movement potential in something outside of myself, and the fact, well, if I can make this thing move in a beautiful, graceful way, well, all I have to do is take that same energy and translate it up my own arm and work backwards. I mean, usually what a performer tries to do, what a puppeteer tries to do, is take an impulse from inside and channel it through their arms, through their hands, through this instrument, this musical instrument of the puppet in front of them. And I did it in the reverse. I found that the puppet moved far more gracefully than I could. So I found myself trying to draw lessons from it. And it has been a happy symbiosis ever since.
Eileen Blumenthal, let me ask you, where do puppets fit in a digital world? You know, a puppet is such you know, like where do they fit? Now we've got CGI, we've got all these characters we can create that you don't necessarily need a puppeteer, I suppose, or maybe you do. Like, where do they fit today?
I think the analogy that Jen made earlier about puppets as musical instruments comes in here. You can have digitally created music and it can sound really, really good. But I don't think a digitally created music will ever have the sound quality of a live cellist playing a cello. And in the same way, a live actor, puppeteer, channeling his expression through the instrument of a puppet has something really special and unique about it. That said, there certainly are worlds that are opened by digital music and there are worlds that are opened by digital puppetry. And I don't mean to say, you know, one is better and should preclude the other. But they're different. There's still room for a live puppeteer, just as there's still room for a live cellist.
It's Eileen Blumenthal, author of the book Puppetry, A World History. And Jennifer Barnhart, master puppeteer, who's now performing in the musical Avenue Q off-Broadway at New World Stages in New York City. They both joined us from New York. And Jennifer and Eileen, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Here at University of Utah, Avenue Q runs through November 24th at the Babcock Theater. You can call 801-581-7100 for tickets or just go online, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.